Welcome back, everybody. This is the Bless Your Boys podcast. BlessYourBoys.com is your home for all things Detroit Tigers baseball on the SB Nation platform. I'm your host, Brandon Day, and with me is my co-host, Ashley McLennan. Ashley, how's it going?
Pretty awesome.
Excellent. And we have a special guest for you all tonight. You knew him. You may know him again after tonight, and you loved him. Andy Dierks, former Detroit Tigers outfielder, has joined us tonight, and we're going to talk a little bit about what he's been up to in his years since retiring. And we'll go back and talk a little bit about the days with the Tigers and see if maybe we can get some kind of good Jim Leland horseshit type quote out of you about Jim Leland as we go along. So, Andy, thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Yeah, of course. Happy to do it. I don't know about if I'm a special guest, but I'm a guest nonetheless. I'm excited to be here. There's a lot of good people out there on Bless Your Boys. You guys do good work. I'm pumped up. Let's see what you got for me tonight.
All right. Sounds good. And, you know, I mean, Detroit is a town that, you know, that really loves its kind of blue collar players. Obviously, you know, Don Kelly is revered, you know, beyond his, you know, his actual stats on the playing field. And I think, you know, you were kind of a guy who, you know, I think fit that description for a lot of people as well. So we're pretty excited to have you. And, you know, I thought what we would do, we're going to kind of start out with what you've been up to since leaving baseball, and then kind of we'll work back into the Tigers days. Where I wanted to start is in the present. You know, any baseball player hears the term, you know, the process a million different times, sticking with the process. And a big part of that is about living in the present. So we thought we'd start with what you've been up to since your retirement from baseball. Can you kind of talk to us a little bit about kind of what that was like for you, making the decision to retire, and then what you've been up to since?
Yeah, so transitions in life come, they're inevitable, right? They're going to happen. And I always tell people, some people say, man, that's awful. You know, two back surgeries, you're just really kind of getting to the peak of your major league career. And it's inevitable that as any athlete, there's going to be a time where you're going to have to step away from the game. Sometimes it's voluntarily. Sometimes it's not due to injuries or different things. I think anybody, when you hit that point, that stage of your life, you have to step back and kind of reanalyze what you're doing. Because I was baseball 24/7, mm-hmm. right? It was live it, eat it, breathe it. I was playing in the Dominican in the winter, playing for the Tigers all summer. Like everything in my life kind of revolved around baseball. So after it happened and I had to step out of that baseball role, all I did was decide, you know what? I've been successful at something. And like you said, stick to the process. I can be successful in anything I want to do. Mm-hmm. If I just use that same mindset, now finding the avenue was my next step. Luckily, I was in, we were in Kansas City at the time, me and my wife, looking for a house. We ended up just walking up to a house that we saw a picture of and saying, hey, we like this one. There happened to be a realtor there who had a really good experience with. And she said, you know, have you ever thought about doing real estate? Because she knew I was kind of in the after my second one, I was doing the rehab process, which was pretty strenuous and not much fun.
Yeah.
But was getting through that. And then at that time, talking with my surgeon and everybody saying, you know, baseball is probably not an option from here on out. And it's kind of like, whoa, you know, what do you mean? Baseball is not an option. I'm only like 29 years old. I'm supposed to be able to play till I'm 35, 36.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But,
had you ever had a good experience with her?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had a good experience with her and then jumped right into the real estate gig and have really enjoyed it, have massive success moving back to the Detroit area. Has been great, and then continuing my profession here, it's been a good journey.
Oh, that's great to hear. Had you ever given, you know, a moment's thought to what you might do when baseball was over during your career, or when you're in college or anything?
Yeah, of course. So when my career path was different, everybody's got their own story, right? I was a small town kid from Kansas. I was originally going to join the military. My mom talked me out of that. And said, hey, go take this junior college scholarship and just do it for 2 years, you know, and see where it takes you. I had an offer from Wichita State also, but I was extremely raw. I had some ability. I could run a little bit. You know, I had a little bit of physical strength, things like that, decent hand-eye coordination. but was never like the guy, the prospect, especially being from a town of 1,100 people, right?
Yeah. Is that Hutchinson?
So then it just kind of morphed. Well, Haven, Kansas is where I'm from.
Oh,
it's
Haven.
Out, right outside of Hutchinson. Yeah, a little bitty blurb on a map. Great place to grow up and live. Country. I grew up on a dirt road about 8 miles from a town of 1,200 or 1,100.
That's awesome.
So exposure was not something that was common, right? Now, I played baseball, you know, all growing up, loved the game, but I also liked to do a lot of other things. You know, I played football, basketball, baseball. I liked to fish and hunt. I was an active guy. And then as the baseball process started, one thing that I really would take out of my success of going through junior college to Division I to pro ball, low A, high A, double A, triple A, big leagues, and then two tours in the Dominican, every level that I was at, I had to prove myself, you know, and I kind of attached to that challenge is the way I looked at it. I didn't realize it at the time, but I'm kind of a guy who's motivated by challenge. And it's really helped me succeed in a lot of different facets of life.
Do you think, do you think it's pretty different for guys who are drafted, you know, and, you know, first round, you know, guys who come in with huge expectations? Do you think it was better for you that you were kind of overlooked in that way?
Well, you know, it helped build character, but it's something that I had already kind of had instilled in me due to my upbringing. I was extremely lucky to have a great set of parents and some great mentors that kind of stayed out of my way per se. You know, they would advise me and help me with skills and stuff, but at the end of the day, they wanted me to enjoy what I was doing. Their biggest concern was, hey, did he go out there and play hard today? Something I could control. It was never a lot of pressure put on me, where you see kids now and guys high draft picks, and it is a lot of pressure. I would imagine it can be overwhelming. You know, like I said, everybody's journey is different. I think if you can just attach to the process, and especially for guys who are the higher round draft picks and things of that, I was drafted in the 8th round as a senior, didn't get drafted as a junior. But I think if you can realize that I need to prove it all the time, everywhere I go, then you'll be fine. But if you feel like I got drafted, I'm a high round draft pick, so I'm owed something, you're already behind the game.
Yeah, for sure.
And you see that with guys. Sometimes it takes them a little bit to realize, hey, I need to get out here and produce, because everybody out here right now is working harder and they want to get after it. So I need to get on that same level. Yeah, I might have a little more talent, but we all know, that talent isn't the only derivative. It's not the only factor that can get a guy to the big leagues.
Well, absolutely. And you look at these guys too, that are the number, you know, first round draft picks, and yeah, they're the best guys at their university, but you get to the big leagues and you're the little fish in the big pond, right? So it's suddenly there's these guys that are much, much, much better than you that you're facing. And it's like, oh, okay. You know, I was the best at where I was, but now I'm in the big show and everyone here is the best at what they do.
And that's a big part
and
of
it's
the
a worldwide game.
Yeah. Yeah. All of a sudden the pool is really deep. That's a big part of player development, right? Is really trying to match, you know, the player to the right level where he's challenged. He feels, you know, that little bit of stress, like I've got to keep up with what everyone's going on around me. But isn't just kind of cranking home runs and having an easy time of it. You got to kind of find that balance point where guys are pushed without being broken, right?
Yeah, and it's different for everybody. And with that said, even I know guys who repeat levels who maybe, you know, in a different organization would have got promoted. You got to take that with the right attitude too. Baseball in itself, it doesn't matter what level you're playing at. It's a different kind of game. There's a reason that the minor league system's so deep. And there's a reason that, you know, like football, if you're big, fast, strong, you're going to have a spot. There's just no way around it. You know, on the defensive side of the ball, baseball is such a skill set game and a mindset game that it takes a while to develop those. So whatever level that a guy's playing at, it's going to be challenging. Even so, you can take a guy who's successful in double A, just because he goes back to high A, it doesn't mean that it's easy to hit a round ball with a round bat. Now, your experience should promote you to succeed more. Your mindset, the things that you have learned at that level before, and that's where, okay, if a guy does have to take a step back or repeat a level, I've seen it too many times where they think that that's like a knock against them. They say, hey, I proved it. What I would tell those guys over and over, this is a game that you have to prove yourself day in, day out for your entire career. It doesn't matter what you're doing, what you did yesterday or the day before, until maybe you sign a big long-term contract and you get a little more freedom, right?
Yeah.
But for most guys in a system, if it's what have you done for me lately? And that's what a lot of guys kind of, you can get in that lull state of, no, I've done it, I've proved it, I'm a good double-A hitter. And then you go up to triple-A, and the difference between double-A and triple-A that I saw was you go against playing against a bunch of 20 to 25-year-olds to playing against a bunch of grown men. You know, there's 35-year-olds up there, and they have families, and it's just a different atmosphere. And that was kind of the big, like, wow, these guys are grown men playing this game. It's not you're playing against the college guys that you played against coming up anymore.
Yeah, and that's kind of when you start feeling that job part, right? Where it's, I mean, you've got to go out there and you've got to produce every day. It's the consistency. Because even Justin Verlander, I assume, you know, goes out there after all he's accomplished and is ultra competitive and feels like he has to prove himself with every start. And that's the mentality you have to find a way to develop and not kind of try to find excuses to get away from or, you know, to kind of shy off of that mentality.
Yeah, and that's where... So I really do believe that Wilford Petro has this law. It's called the law of 80-20. You know, in the big leagues, it would break down to 20% of the guys in the big leagues are kind of just destined to be there, in my opinion. They're just that good.
Yeah.
Like, regardless of kind of their skill set, their size, just the way they naturally know the game and can play it, they're kind of going to make it, and barring some injury or something like that, right? So Justin Verlander is a good example. He matured a little later, but an arm like that is going to make it. Now, what he did with that arm was every day he competed with that arm and refined his mindset, which is going to put him into the Hall of Fame. Right?
Yeah.
So he was probably going to make it to the big leagues with his stuff and his arm and his capabilities, and but his mindset is pushing him over that level to become more of a baseball legend. Same way with Miguel Cabrera. And then there's guys like me and Don Kelly, who are the 80% that are filling in the gaps. So there's a lot for grabs, in my opinion, in the big leagues. And a lot of guys, some guys disagree with me on this, but I've seen it firsthand. You know, I've passed guys who, talent-wise, physicality-wise, were better than me. There's no way around it. In BP, they can hit the ball a mile, and they run the fastest 60 times. They do all this stuff on paper, and now you get into analytics, and they'd be like, oh, his launch angle and his exit velocity, yeah, blah, 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 blah. But can he play the game of baseball? That's what it comes down to.
Do you think, and you kind of mentioned this with the guys that you're passing that are, like, technically better, is there a kind of, and you're talking about mentality, is there a mental block there where guys are seeing players that are they consider not to be better than them or worse than them advancing faster? Is there like a resentment there that may be holding them back because they're too focused on other people or something along those lines? Like, is there any of that that maybe goes on when guys in the minors are seeing people advance ahead of them when they think that they should already be there?
There's a ton of that. So people, inevitably, all of us, we all think we're very, very important. what I try to get through to people is make them understand you are not nearly as important as you think you are, and you're expendable to a point, like in baseball and in life even at times. If I was to walk out of my house right now and get hit by a school bus, tragic, Andy Dirks dies at 32, got hit by a school bus, my wife and my kids and my mom and my brother and sister, something like that, would be very sad, and they would, you know, everybody else, though, for the most part, even some of my friends, so sad, so tragic, they move on with life. So if you take that's a guy who's been pretty successful and done some things in life, dying, and it's not that big a deal. So if a guy's outplaying you, the scouts and everybody that sees that, you're not owed anything. If you think you're better than somebody else, you need to prove that. Just because you think it, or somebody's told you that, or maybe in high you were the guy and you go to double A and you think you can outplay this guy, you have to prove it. That's just the bottom line. And that's what you see these guys get in that mold of, well, I'm better than so-and-so, so I should be there regardless. No. It's a game where you have to prove yourself. And do some guys get a little edge because the organization's got more money in them? Of course. It's common sense. They see a higher ceiling for him than they see for you. So, of course, he's going to get maybe promoted ahead and try to push him a little bit to see if they can hit that higher ceiling with him. But at the end of the day, if he doesn't figure it out and learn how to do it, it doesn't matter if they gave you $20 million. If you're not going to help the big league club succeed, they're not going to put you there.
In the end, I mean, you're that investment in you only gets you so much extra leeway, and you'd be, you know, well advised not to try to waste any of it if possible. Yeah.
That's a fact. Yeah. There's not this game. It's, you think about a career, a good major league career, five to 10 years, right? That's not a very long time. 5 years goes by fast.
Yeah.
You know, so in the minor leagues, if you get an extra 2 years because you're a first round pick, that's about what you're going to get. There's just no way. There's an influx of players coming in all the time, and you can't look behind you, but you have to know that those guys behind you who got drafted the year after you are coming. Like, they want it. How bad do you want it? You got to push and fight and scrap and claw. And if you do that, there's a chance. If you have some ability and you start playing the game that way, as opposed to, and looking ahead, I think is another issue guys in the minor leagues really, they stress out because when they're going good, they're always looking at the guy above them in the kind of the same position.
Yep.
And if he's struggling, automatically they're like, I should be that guy. Hey, homie, you've been doing it for a week, right? Like, you're hot for a week. Be hot for 2 months, be hot for a year, be hot for 2 years. You know, it's like, it's the instant gratification thing. And then what happens is he's resentful that the organization maybe isn't pushing him forward.
Yeah.
But in reality, the guy above him has proven at the level he was at that he could already do that, right? And he's hitting a little funk, and then he gets out of his funk, and this guy rides that high for a little bit and crashes and burns.
Yeah.
And then he looks around and is waiting for somebody to console him. There's nobody there.
Just
life.
And that's, you know, and I think that's a microcosm. Yeah. And it's a microcosm of what, you know, I think most people, you know, see in their work life. It's just that it's got to be so amplified when you've got a bunch of, you know, young guys in their late teens and 20s who are ultra competitive and, you know, putting in this work and this sweat and wanting it so bad. You know, it's got to be just an incredibly charged environment to kind of come up in.
Yeah. And one thing I realized, and I didn't even, you don't realize it while you're in it and while you're doing it. So I ended my career of, you know, the pinnacle, the big leagues, right? When I got back into what people always tell me is the real world, you know, oh, you got to get in the workforce, the real world now, stuff like that. One thing I noticed was I was surrounded by guys doing things at extremely high levels with focus and different kind of determination. And I got into real estate, which of all games, I figured out a lot of people want to say they're working hard and they're doing the things they need to do. In reality, only a very small percentage are.
Yeah.
And that was kind of an eye-opening thing for me because I thought I was going to get into this ultra-competitive business of real estate.
Yeah, a lot of it was eyewash.
What I learned quickly, and a lot of it's eyewash, and a lot of people choose their real estate agent just basically based off of their family friend.
Yeah.
They got a cousin that does it, or their brother does it, or, and that was kind of like, you see what they're doing. All they're doing is kind of leaning on the people they know to get business. You know, it was kind of like, oh, this thing is wide open.
Well, and humans have a great, you know, a great desire to be comfortable, don't they? Like, there's that natural urge to seek comfort when things are stressful. Like sometimes that can be a family friend.
And it's understandable.
Sure. So let's talk a little bit. Can we talk a little bit?
You can trust.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, just to kind of, I want to really tie in, you know, get your game right podcast and the whole kind of effort, and kind of mention that. And can you kind of talk about how, you know, these lessons start to relate to, you know, what you're talking about in the podcast? I've heard a couple episodes. You know, you've had some great player development and scouting guests on that I've already heard, and kind of the mentality that you're articulating, you know, just shines throughout the whole podcast. So can you kind of talk about how that relates to what you've learned as, you know, the podcast?
Yeah. So we're starting the podcast. What we're trying to do, what I've tried to do, and I've had this idea for a while, we're getting it into motion and getting it into play. I think it's very relevant for anybody who wants to succeed in baseball, softball, really any sport, and really in life. The biggest separating factor, when I look back at my career and what I was able to accomplish, and then what other guys were able to accomplish, seeing them kind of do the same thing, was the mindset. It was the mindset of how they approached the game, how they approached themselves, how they approached their focus on a daily basis. It's not complicated. It's not like a magic pill that you can take, and it's not about launch angle and exit velocity. It's not about those things. It's about a guy being determined to use his mental capacity on top of his physical capacity to excel his game. So with Get Your Game Right, we're getting on podcast because I knew right away I was a good player. I know the player side of it very well, but the coaching side, the dad side, you know, and it kind of started too. I was getting calls from dads now that my number is available, which is cool for me to have people say, "Hey, Andy, I got a 14-year-old that loves the game of baseball. You know, he's good or whatever. He likes it. What do I do with him?" So that's a great question. He's like, "I never played baseball. And if I did, it was limited. You know, I played in high school. That was 25 years ago. What do I do with this kid? Like, what kind of advice does he need to be getting?" And then you kind of look across the scale, the way baseball's going with all the travel teams and all these showcase camps and
it's perfect.
A lot
game
of it to me is a money grab.
Oh,
you're hitting parents right in their wallet. Hey, you want little Johnny to have a shot? You got to come to this camp and pay us $250. You need to go to this showcase for $300. You need to take him across country. He needs to, if he's from Michigan in the summers, he should go down to Texas and play on this Texas team. I'm like, this is the most absurd stuff I've ever heard. if you are good enough, if you're good enough and you put in the effort that it takes and you're searching for the answers, you're going to make it. I can't stress it enough to a kid. All I'm trying to do, I would never promise a kid to make it to the big leagues. That's just stupid, right? That's like saying, "Hey, I'll make you a millionaire tomorrow if you do this." You see all those commercials and stuff. No. I want to take a kid that if he's passionate about baseball or a girl that's passionate about softball or whoever it is, whatever their skill ability is, their skill level that you're born with, we don't choose it. We're born with it, right?
Yeah.
Whatever that ability is, I want to help you learn how to maximize it the right way. There are so many good coaches out there. There's so many good people out there and resources that are very capable of teaching kids the fundamentals of the game. Taking the same swings, they can teach them how to throw the baseball, field the ground ball. They can teach them you need to tag up on a pop fly. I don't think, however, there's as many people that are as capable of teaching the mindset, the mental aspects, the thought process, how to really break that down and make it understandable at a simple level that it's achievable on a daily basis.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because, kids can get, you know, decent coaching on YouTube if, you know, if all they're looking for is drills and that sort of thing. But learning how to apply it consistently like that would seem to be the key that's often left out.
I think it's actually a huge thing. So even at like a major league level, you look at guys who kind of get there finally and seem to like get in their own head. And it seems like this is as vital a part of somebody coming up to any level as having the pure skill.
Yeah, And I love how you just said that. So we hear these things time and time again, like he's just in his own head. Hey, he needs to get out of his own head. Okay, that's great. I've heard that a million times too. I've had coaches tell me that. Hey, Dirks, you just need to get out of your own head. All right, cool. How do I do that?
Yeah. Stop thinking, Andy.
Stop thinking, right? You hear these things. So how does the guy actually do that? So I break it down, and I call it, it's part of my Slump Buster toolkit that I'm putting out. The first thing you got to do to realize, to get out of your own head, be somebody different. I call it the mimic. So when you're a kid playing in the backyard, who are you yourself, or are you acting like your idols?
Yeah, right.
You're acting like these uber successful guys who are confident and get it done on a daily basis, and you think they're the best things in sliced bread. It's no different in the big leagues. Guys in the big leagues do this stuff. So when you're in your own head, or you have that kid who's in their own head, just ask them, hey, who's your favorite player? Oh, Mike Trout. Cool. You know what I want you to be today? Mike Trout. Act like Mike Trout. What that does is it takes you out of your own brain, and now you're using their confidence and their power to get you out of your own head and help start pushing you forward and excelling. I had some of my best times in the big leagues. I was Manny Ramirez. I was nice. Moises Alou. Like, I was these different guys in the big leagues.
Oh, yeah.
It works. But for most people, they say, get out of your own head. Oh, that'd be great. I wish I could.
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice?
So that's a technique to kind of, get past that block, like to give yourself like something else to think about. You've got to replace, whatever thoughts are holding you back with the thoughts that you would imagine Mike Trout would have, or Miguel Cabrera, or someone like that.
That's right. So most people, when they approach a slump, when they're struggling, so they're approaching a slump, right? One for the last 15, one for the last 22. What happens is, naturally, you start searching. And when I say searching, you're looking for information from anybody. You could be at the Taco Bell drive-thru and be like, hey, man, do you know how to hit a slider? The guy could be like, yeah, try this. Oh, I'll try it for sure.
Yeah.
So the reality is, most coaches, when you get into that phase, because they say you need to get out of your own head, but all they really know how to focus on is the mechanics, they start messing with swings.
Yeah.
And that compounds the issue big time. So they'll take an 0 for 10 and turn it into that 1 for 25 by, you need to raise your hands, you need to do X, Y, and Z. I've seen my swing on film probably 5,000 times.
Yeah.
The one thing I realized was my swing kind of was what it was. As much as I try to manipulate it, guys would say, hey, you need to look at this Barry Bonds film. Try to swing like that. Cool. That would be awesome, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
If me and Barry Bonds had if I had the exact same flexibility, stature, strength, all the aspects that it takes when you swing a bat, it's different for every human. Oh, man, that'd be great if I had that, right? But the way I swing a bat is just different. And once I kind of learned that and fell back to my swing is kind of what it is, I can make a few minor tweaks here and there, but overall, I would think that I was changing something major, and I'd go watch it on film. It looks exactly the same.
Fascinating, yeah. So, I mean, a lot of times when you're struggling, people naturally start to flail around, right? Like, it's very hard for people to react to stress with patience and sort of a steadiness. Our natural inclination is always like, you should be doing something. You should be changing everything, if this isn't going right. And you can just kind of work yourself, it's paralysis by analysis has kind of always been the golf term for that. it does seem like that could very easily take over any baseball player, especially when you see what pitchers are bringing nowadays, the focus it takes to hit at the major league level. I think sometimes people think like, oh, this guy wasn't a very good major league player. And it's also, whoever they're thinking about. And it's important to remember just how few people make it to the major leagues out of the enormous pool of kids that grow up playing baseball. I mean, it's just such a narrow funnel at the end. And the difference, it seems like, between, a great player and a good player is probably to some degrees maybe narrower than we think it is. So yeah, I really like that you're, you know, kind of taking some of these sort of platitudes, like get out of your own head, and trying to actually articulate what you should do, like what proactive action you should take, as opposed to stop doing this or stop doing that.
Yeah, and most of the proactive stuff that we try to do is mechanical. We go in the cage and bang out more. We get more balls. We do, you know, as a pitcher, if your command's off, you're in the bullpen and you're just, all you're thinking about is command, and you become so obsessed with your issue, as opposed to, let's peel the layers back a little bit. They're trying to fix their command by gripping the ball differently and doing different things, right? As opposed to, let's peel this back. Let's make something achievable for a kid. He's missing high and arm side. 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 Okay, an adjustment would be, hold on to the baseball longer, dummy. Like, it's not your grip. It's not how you're, like, seriously, let's get it simple. And I got Brent Chemnitz. He's actually the winningest pitching coach in Division I history. He's big on the mental side of baseball, and he's part of Get Your Game Right, too. He's got some great stuff that digs into this, and I can't wait for people to see it.
Oh, that's awesome. Are you still in touch with people at Wichita State at all? Do you ever go back there? Or?
Well, they changed coaches. So Gene Stevenson was there when I was there. They changed Todd Butler, you know, and I don't go back there anymore. I used to work out there in the off season some, you know, because I was still living in the Wichita area. But I haven't been back in quite a while, but I still have a really good relationship with Brent. That's kind of the extent of it, really.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I just was, you know, Wichita State still seems to produce some pretty good players. So, you know, I noticed Alec Baum this year was a really high draft pick out of there and looked like a monster. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a consistently good baseball school for a long time, it seems like.
Yeah, they built that program from nothing and turn it into, they won national championship in 89. We went to a few super regionals when I was there, and then always have guys getting drafted. You know, my year was like me, Connor Gillespie, who's been in the big leagues for a decent amount of time now. And then we had a couple draft pick pitchers who didn't make to the big leagues. But I mean, just to get drafted is incredible. And then going back to that, like you said, what separates a good player from a great player is a narrow margin. And I think that margin gets overlooked as the mentality aspect, which for a scout, any scout knows, baseball is the hardest game to scout. First of all, the hardest part about it is the mindset, the mentality is so strong.
Yeah.
It's such a big part of success that you can't, it's hard to teach. It's hard to articulate. And that's what we're trying to break that barrier down. I think it's the most overlooked part of the game. We went from steroid era to no steroids. We're always trying to find an advantage, and right now they're trying to find it with technology.
Yeah.
I'm here to tell you, these guys with the technology are way freaking smarter than us baseball players.
Like, these I was guys worried you were going to say something bad about analytics and Brandon's heart was going to break.
No.
I'm not
Mr. Analytics over here.
I love technology. I think it's a cool aspect that they're bringing in. I think there is a place for it. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's the end all be all.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting.
I don't think analytics is the end all be all.
Yeah. Especially when you're learning the game, when you're, you know, it's a whole different thing when you're just a fan looking from the outside, trying to understand what's going on. Sometimes those things can help, but most of that stuff, I can't really imagine being particularly useful to a young player until, you know, they're making, you know, minute little adjustments, you know, like guys using high speed cameras to check their slider grip, this kind of thing. Like, that, you know, that stuff's not going to change anything for you when you're 18, 19 years old.
No. And even guys in the big leagues, so take this example. I always see when I'm watching TV, they, you know, they hit the home run and they do the whole breakdown. X amount of miles an hour off the bat, X, Y, yeah. And Z. What a beautiful swing. He caught it right. I've never seen him do it when the guy hits one off the top of his hand and the bat shatters into 500 pieces and the ball goes about 5 feet out in front of home plate.
Oh, they've done them and they spike them right into the ground, and it's like a 35 mile an hour exit velocity. Those are my favorite StatCast moments. Yeah, that was a hit.
Yeah, because it is funny, like the exit velocity launch angle stuff. It's like I saw the ball. I saw what happened. You know, it doesn't change anything to know that it was 105 miles per hour rather than 103. So yeah.
But I think it's, and one of the cool things about baseball is it's the fans, right? The people and people who like to analyze the game. There's a hunger to analyze baseball because it is such an intricate game. It's like a symphony, you know, it's like an orchestra of things happening all at once. And when it's in unison, it's the most beautiful sound you've ever heard. But when one of those, when the guy with the cymbals back there is just going, like all of a sudden everything, the wheels fall off, you know, and it's just one person, one thing, one little element. So with the guy, his timing's a little off. He's got the most beautiful swing ever, but can never be on time with the baseball, or has never figured out a way to stay on time with the baseball. You're never going to see that result, you know? So it's such an interesting game.
Yeah, and there's all these pauses, you know, like each pitch is its own sort of like, you know, individual game, but then the whole thing is kind of, like you said, kind of taking place in this tapestry of each of these little individual events, you know, like the fielders are interacting with the ball and the base runners are running. Yeah, there's all these kind of disparate things kind of happening all around the ball, but the pitcher starts it each time and there's, you know, 280, 300 pitches per game. So you have each of these little moments, these little start points. All throughout it. It is the best. It's just the best game, Andy.
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt. I mean, you get to play it every day. You can always watch baseball. And then you put the stats on top of it, which, you know, once they started putting my batting average up on the big screens, you know, in the minor leagues, that can be scary. Yeah, that's an obstacle a guy's got to overcome because you're on the road and, you know, early in the season, if you start a little slow, you're hitting a buck 88, you know, and you're hitting as a three hole. They're like, why are you in the three hole? Like, oh boy.
Yeah. Give me a month. All right.
It's out there for the world to see how bad you've been lately. You know?
Yep. Easier at the end of the season when it's kind of balanced out a little more. Yeah. Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. Or, you know, but if you're hitting 405, it's like, oh, I'm the man, you know, and the whole aspect of baseball, and the cool part about it is over time, if you're consistent and you use that mindset, use your abilities, always refine your skill set. So a big thing that I always try to train kids, and I don't want to get off on these training topics too much. We can talk about some other fun stuff too. So you have a skill set, right? You're trying to use that skill set to complete a task, which is going to give you a result. So, you know, your skill set, if you're a good contact hitter but don't have a lot of power, your task should probably be to try to hit a line drive somewhere. And then that result is going to be the how well your skill set goes into the task. What the missing link there between skill set and task is the focus. What are you thinking about? To take that skill set and do the task to get the proper result. You know, and I fell into it a lot too at times because we were just kind of coming off the eras of outfielders hitting 50 home runs, you know, and you start thinking, I need to be a guy that can hit home runs to be able to have a shot at the big leagues. When in reality, no, guys now, you know, 20 home runs in a year is outstanding. So me breaking out of that mold of trying to do too much, that was always something that I struggled with because I was a gap-to-gap hitter. I didn't have massive power. I could get you, you know, if you messed up and I got it right. But if I got into that mindset, I'd start pulling my front shoulder out and start causing some issues. It wasn't, my mechanics were off, but it was caused by what I was thinking.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you think that this is a particular topic that's been on my mind a lot lately, just kind of watching the Tigers farm system. Do you think guys can be taught plate discipline, or is it something that like you can kind of help a guy, but more or less you just kind of have to go out there and figure it out for yourself as time goes. Because I just don't see a lot of guys who don't walk in the minor leagues and then eventually kind of figure it out late. Like it does happen, but you know that kind of thing seems like almost an innate gift that past a certain point it's really hard to develop.
Yeah, that's a great topic. I was lucky to have a guy by the name of Toby Hera. You remember Toby. Toby Hera was, he was a great hitting coach. He was the minor league roving hitting coach when I was kind of going through. One of my best mentors as far as hitting goes when I was in pro ball, because he saw me a lot. He knew me very well, right? His biggest thing when it came to plate discipline was you're going to kind of learn it as you go. You have to stay aggressive. Because what happens is you start telling a young kid, you need this plate discipline. The problem with these young kids is that creeps into their head, and then they'll swing at everything. It's like your brain can only process a certain amount of information at a time. When you're in the game, you need to be focused so intently on what the pitcher's trying to do and have some kind of plan that you can execute. And for most guys, especially young guys, hit the ball back up the middle, right? Try to hit a line drive back up the middle, kind of alleviates a lot of problems. It also, if you have a task, say, okay, I'm swinging at the high pitch too much, whatever it is. That was kind of a struggle I had. What I would do then is say, okay, I need to try to hit a one hop ground ball off that pitcher's foot. What that would do is kind of naturally lower my sights.
Yeah.
And get me adjusted into that zone where I could accomplish that task. Because I had to have the right pitch to be able to accomplish that task. Now, if you're just up there swinging, which a lot of guys with plate discipline problems have, and I'd go through stages like that, and I wish I had developed all this knowledge and stuff and written it down, because it always takes me like too long to remember it. But it's your focus on what kind of task you're trying to produce. So, say for instance, runner at second, nobody out. We got to get that guy to third base, however we can do it, right? We have a task. Now, am I going to be able to take that fastball that's 2 inches outside and wrap around it and try to pull it to the second baseman? It's going to be difficult. But if I have my sights set on, okay, I need to hit the ball hard on the ground to the second baseman, naturally my focus is going to be on pitch that I can do that job with. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So leading yourself by the goal rather than trying to just focus on I'm sitting this pitch or I'm sitting this zone.
Yeah. Yeah. The setting on a pitch for me never worked. Some guys, it takes a lot of discipline and it takes a lot of maturity. And really, I don't think guys can really start setting on pitches until you see the same pitcher over and over. Or a guy's just throwing you a lot of curveballs. This is the way I did it. And this is a very effective way. A lot of guys in the big leagues do it this way. You're not so much setting on a particular pitch. You're setting more on a speed, and this is how you do it. So if a guy's throwing me slow curveball, say a left-handed pitcher is throwing me the slow curveball that I'm just out in front of, I can't get on it, right? What I do then is I'm trying to hit the ball over the third baseman's head.
Oh, yeah.
What it naturally does is makes me stay back longer.
Yeah.
You let the ball travel. Yeah.
Most guys that do that, they're not going to kill you with the fastball. You know, most of those guys, they throw, say they're throwing 86, whatever, 88. Depending on the guy, 88 can jump on you. But if they're throwing me that slow hook or that slider away and I'm just having trouble with it, that's where I got to think, okay, I'm going to hit a screaming line drive over the third baseman's head. Problem solved. Staying back longer. Seen the ball longer keeps me off of bad pitches that are down in the zone on that curveball. Because that's all, when people struggle with curveballs, they're not seeing the ball long enough.
Yeah.
They're swinging for the fastball.
Yeah.
They don't know how to slow their brain down.
Oh, that's pretty interesting. So rather than like trying to, okay, I'm struggling with the slow curveball and focusing on, you know, kind of what you're trying not to have happen. You know, like, okay, I've got to try to watch for the pop out of the guy's hand because, you know, I'll know it's a curveball if it starts up. All that kind of stuff. You can't really do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's too, the game happens too fast. So I think an average fast, this is a 90 mile an hour fastball takes about 3/10 of a second to get out of the pitcher's hand to home plate. So if I don't know if my vision was bad or what. I never really saw spin. You know, Miggy said Miggy could see it, and that's a gift he has, right? Like, he'd be like, oh, don't you see, like, out of his hand? I'm like, what are you talking about? You know?
Like, he can slow down time.
Yeah, yeah. And it's one of those abilities that he has. I wasn't fortunate enough to have that. I think most guys, if they're really honest with themselves, once in a while I'd see a ball out of the hand if the guy was going to hang, if it just, he messed the pitch up. But when the arm speeds get higher and guys are throwing cutters and there's just no way you can see the spin on an 88 mile an hour slider. It for me.
It's all happening. Yeah, it's all happening.
So that's where that's where your adjustment has to be. And so going back to the curveball, and before I learned how to make that adjustment, I would set on a curveball, and then it would be there, and I would still be out in front of the stupid thing. So I had to refine what I'm doing here, right? And that's called making an adjustment. Good players, the best players, and you're talking about the difference between the good and the great, can make an adjustment from pitch to pitch. Hitters. Same with pitcher. So a pitcher throws a two-seam fastball down and away, doesn't have a lot of action on it, kind of leaves it over the plate, guy hits double in the gap. But he knows his adjustment right then. Oh, got to stay a little more close on the front side. Wham, get my action back. Maybe I try to overthrow that pitch, which happens in this game now non-stop. It drives me nuts. If the guy throws 88 to 90, he's getting ground balls, he's working the zone, he's pounding it. As soon as he's throwing 92, and Porcello dealt with this a lot. As soon as he's throwing 92 to 94, his stuff flattens out.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting. He was always better when he was like 89, 91 with the sink. Yeah.
And that's part of knowing your skill set, being really honest with yourself. What kind of player are you? You know, are you going to go out there to light up the radar guns? And I had a good interview with Larry Swanson. I don't know if you've listened to it yet or not. And we talked about kind of the creativity part of the game has wavered for especially the pitchers. You know, now it's how hard can I throw? How hard can I throw the slider? And I'm only going to go 5 innings. So before, guys used to go 9 innings. The starter would go all 9 or 8, and then they'd bring a guy in the bullpen. You get through the lineup that third time, then the fourth time, and your arm's dragging. You got to find ways to be creative to get these guys out, because it's not just going to be stuff. So as opposed to coming out and you're 94 to 96 all game, cool. Okay, that was great. But you went 4 2/3 and – and now the bullpen's got to wear it. Luckily, in baseball, there is enough guys. But the starter is supposed to be one of the pitchers on the team who's got enough stuff and can command his pitches enough to continually get guys out. Now, when they start talking on the TV and stuff, oh, we got to get him out before the third time through the lineup. I'm like, that's not a starting pitcher. Like, you try to pull Verlander because...
Oh, no.
Oh, well, it's third time through. It's like, no, I'm going to still get guys out. You know, I know that my pitch is what I'm doing here. And Ver would do it all the time. He would start the game out sometimes at 88 to 90, you know. And then when he needs that ace, he's got it.
Yeah.
But why is he going to wear himself out early in the game knowing that I'm going to go deep into this game?
Yeah, you know, it's like
That's a lost art in baseball.
I know I've heard that from even Tiger Woods, to take it to another sport, you know, where you go 85% until so that you always have that extra when you're in a jam, you know, in the late innings when Verlander needed to throw 99, 100 to close out his own game. But it just seems like it's just a rare breed that can do that kind of thing now. And I don't know if it's because, you know, I don't really understand, and no one seems to have figured this out, why pitchers can't go as deep anymore. And why so many pitchers are getting injured. And I don't know if it's because they're just coming up, throwing as hard as possible, you know, when they're too young to be doing it. And, you know, just trying to get the high draft pick and the big bonus. I don't know if those things are the cause, but it definitely feels like that kind of starting pitching outing is becoming, you know, something of a rare.
Yeah, and it's the radar gun, first of all. So if you go to a showcase, even guys throwing across the diamond, these guys are throwing balls into the bleachers, you know, from third base. Like, come on. That's ridiculous. Guys, the radar guns are back there. They're throwing it to the backstop, trying to hit 95, whatever, right? Trying to hit that magic number to show them they're projectable. To me, it's a complete waste of time, first of all, for anybody involved in that whole system, that whole mindset of, okay, if he hits 95, I might put him on my prospect list. That is, it's terrible for the development of a player, because now all they're worried about is throwing hard. They're not learning how to pitch. You know what I mean? I would rather focus that time and effort on, let's learn how to pitch as you're naturally going to gain your velocity, you know, as you're naturally going to develop into your body. So fastball changeup until you're 16. Then let's maybe work on a little bender. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you can learn how to get guys out just fastball changeup, work a two-seam, work a four-seam changeup, and you can learn how to pitch on those pitches when you're young, you'll develop a little curveball in the slider, and then you're set.
Yeah. Then you can Bartolo Colon your way to age 44. Bartolo's still doing it. They're doing that very thing and still reasonably effective.
Yep. And I think part of his longevity, too, is the way he approaches the game, his mindset. That is a guy who never gets flustered, ever. He's always got a smile on his face. He's like Torii Heiner, you know. Like, those guys just naturally, they don't let the game get to them. They just keep competing and going out there and being a good teammate, having fun, whatever struggles they go through don't last very long. And they always find ways to be productive. It's the way they approach the game.
Just not afraid to fail.
As opposed to, I'm going to approach. Yeah, they're not. And when they do fail, they can just shrug it off. They smile it off. They say, well, you got me that time. I'm going to get you this time. You know? It's not easy to do, though.
Yeah, for sure. Not in front of
emotion involved in baseball.
And you got 40,000 people screaming at you when you don't.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's I'm loving all this stuff. I could just hold you prisoner and make you tell me more about baseball and the intricacies for a long time. But let's go. Let's talk a little bit more about your career with the Tigers. Ashley, you got any? I know you got a couple questions you wanted to go with.
I do. And Andy, you just brought up Torii Hunter, so that kind of is a good segue for me. I kind of want to know about like clubhouse leadership and those guys that kind of rise up and become clubhouse leaders. And like, what does that mean for you guys in a club? Like, what is that guy doing there that helps guide the team? Like, I've been saying that I think Nick Castellanos on the team right now is emerging as a clubhouse leader, but I'm obviously not in the clubhouse. So I'm just curious as to like what that kind of guy is doing for you guys behind the scenes.
Yeah, that's a great question. Leadership, there's thousands of books written on it. Everybody wants a leader, right? I do think that there are people who are more predisposed just based on their personality to become a leader. Usually it's more of your outgoing types. And there are also people who are consistent. And not just consistent on a baseball field, consistent in their life, consistent with what they do. When you want to become a leader or you want to develop as a leader, the first thing you got to realize is I need to first prove it. You have to prove it. Nobody's ever going to follow you if you've never proven anything. So as a baseball player, your leaders are usually the guys who have been there a little bit longer, who have proved more in the game than you have, right?
Yeah.
And then also, they approach every single day. They're there. They're first in the clubhouse. They're taking their swings in the cage. They're helping guys out. They're constantly there and in a supportive role and always doing the right stuff. And those are the guys who it takes time for a leader to kind of develop and emerge. Like you just said, like Nick Castellanos, he's been in the big leagues for a decent little clip now. And he's a guy that has a smile on his face, always there to help a teammate out. And even when he was younger, right, he's always going to be in the clubhouse early. He's always going to be in the batting cage working. He's always going to be the guy that's kind of like, you know, pat you on the butt, yeah, let's go have some fun today. Let's do it, you know? And his personality is attractive. And I think that guys like that, you know, Torrey Hunters, Victor Martinez, guys like that, who every day have a focus, have a determination, it kind of gives somebody, everybody else, somebody to rally around. Like, man, he's doing it. I need to get after it and do it too.
Yeah, but you kind of got to be able to live it before you can, model it.
You have to live it. You have to prove it. You cannot, you have to have some street cred before you're the leader. You can't be the guy coming in from AAA who's having a hot month and just be the leader right away, right?
Yep.
You have to prove it over time. And I think that's the proper way it should be done, because those are the guys with the actual experience. They've been through the highs, the lows, the good teams, the bad teams. They've seen all the different angles of the game compared to if you're 2 years in the big leagues, you haven't seen that much, really. You know, you haven't been on the good teams, the bad teams. You haven't seen success and failure at the level that some of these guys have in the big leagues. You know, what is a slump for them? They've been through a worse slump than you have, I promise, right?
Yeah.
How they get through it, how they keep their head right and keep themselves in the big leagues and then just keep working at that goal.
No, that's awesome. So I just have a quick follow-up because I happen to have the Tigers game on mute going right now. Tigers are playing the Angels, and I'm just curious about West Coast road trips and how they were for you guys. I know for any fans in Michigan, they're like the bane of the existence, like 10 p.m. start times. And I'm just curious if those, like, if there was like a mental like wall that you guys hit doing those trips, or if it was just, hey, we have to take a flight, couple long flights, and it's just normal baseball.
Yeah, it never affected me. I know that it's a big topic, and you know, you see teams go out west, sometimes they struggle, whatever. Maybe it is a factor. For me, I never even thought about it, because by the time you get on the airplane from the other game, you get on the flight, you play a little cards, you take a nap, you wake up. And it's not like you're flying coach on Spirit Airlines. you know, you're flying in the Taj Mahal of jets provided by the Illich family. Amazing. Big seats, pretty comfortable. You get the bus. Everything's catered for you. You're not carrying your own luggage. Like, they're doing everything they can do to help you succeed. When you go play those other teams on the West Coast, I think probably the biggest factor is maybe you don't play them as much. You didn't see those pitchers as much. So it can be a little bit of a challenge there. But at the end of the day, you're going to the ballpark. You kind of have a routine. When you get to the field, guys who stick to the routine never have issues. You know, usually you'll scratch BP if you get in super late.
Yeah.
Which kind of can throw a routine off a little bit. I think probably for the starting pitcher would probably be the worst on the first day getting in, or the first day getting back, because not only did they sit through that whole game, they're starting that next day. Starting pitchers are very routine oriented. So you get to the clubhouse and nobody's there yet. It's got to be weird, right?
Yeah.
It's got to be kind of a different, and most of those guys find ways to get over that and get around it. But I would never say that should ever be an excuse. The way we travel, the food we have, like, everybody's there to help you when you're in the big leagues. That should never be an excuse for anybody to have any struggle at all.
Yeah. I remember Max Scherzer used to like run up and down the hills in the outfield in Anaheim. And it was just hilarious ahead of the games. Mm-hmm. Just doing his up and down the hills. And I'm like, all right, man, that's crazy. But
trying to get some energy out there.
Well, that's why he's good.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, he is a little bit crazy, and it's wonderful.
Yeah, but Max Scherzer does something.
Crazy to play this game.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Okay, let me just take you back real quick here, and we're going to just talk about May 16th, 2011. You made your debut against Kyle Drabik. I think it was the Toronto Blue Jays, and that was the day you got your first. That was the day you got your first hit, and I just wonder, is that a big deal to you? Like, can you remember that distinctly? Do you have the ball, or was it just kind of a moment in time that you just kind of kept going from?
You know, when you bring it up, I remember it. So me and Drabik had history in the minor leagues too.
Oh, okay.
So this guy, when my first year in Double A, Drabik had a really good arm and he kind of jumped out of his hand at 95. He threw up in the zone, which at the time when I was in Double A, most guys weren't doing that. It was my first 3-strikeout game in my professional career.
Oh no!
Against Strayback, he struck me out 3 times. The funny thing is, I get my first hit. It was a little base hit through the 6-hole, which was between third base and shortstop. I get my first hit. I'm juiced up. I'm excited. I didn't know Drabeck had an amazing pickoff move. I got picked off first base. So I remember it very vividly.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's painful. You know, yeah.
I have the ball somewhere, I would imagine. My son, he's 3 now. One day he'll probably dig it up when I have to prove to him that Dad actually played in the major league and was a baseball player. Yeah, right, Dad. You don't know anything, you know. But
before that ball gets thrown to the neighbor dog and stuff, and the dog runs away. Yeah.
I went to the World Series, kid. Believe me.
Yeah, the good thing is we got enough proof via the internet that you can't deny it.
No, I mean, the Tigers never missed the postseason with you on the team. That's like a pretty good record, man.
I'm the link, man.
Yeah.
Most of the places I ever played, we won, which was pretty fortunate.
So, I mean, can we bring you back as a coach or something? That would be great.
I've actually had people reach out to me. I'm at a stage in my life, I'm just not going to do the travel.
Yeah.
I got young kids at the house, a 3-year-old, a 1.5-year-old, and my wife's pregnant.
Oh, wow. Congratulations. I'm at a stage in
my life.
Congratulations, yeah, man. Thanks. Yeah. Oh, and real estate pays, pretty well when you're doing well with it, as you are. So, yeah, you're fine.
Yeah. 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 That's not an issue for me. What I will say, going back to my big league debut, I was a small town kid from Kansas, and you play through the minor leagues, and there's the Mud Hens, beautiful stadium, not that big, right?
Right.
Yeah. I'd been in St. Louis's Busch Stadium, the old one, Mark McGuire,
Yeah.
When I was like 12, and then I think I went to a game at Kauffman Stadium. So I'd been in 2 big league stadiums my entire life as a fan.
Yeah.
Before I ever stepped foot on a big league stadium, starting in left field.
Oh, my God.
So it was – but it was like at first, you get juiced up. And even as my career went on a little bit, when the announcer, put us out on the field and you run out on the field – you get like the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. There's just no way to describe it. Just running out on that field is an amazing feeling. And it's something that, not many people get to do. And I was very grateful to be able to do it and to enjoy it the way I did, even for, it was short lived, but that's life. You got to move on. I was fortunate from what I did when we won the going back to big stadiums, right? So my mom and dad were in 2012 when we beat the Yankees in the ALCS. They came down on the field, and they had watched a few games. They'd watched the games up in the stands. They come down on the field and they're doing the trophy ceremony and stuff. And my parents are, small town people from Kansas. They look up and my dad is very, very. He was a very quiet man, soft spoken. He looked up and he said, "Wow. How do you do this?" this thing is huge, but you get so into the game. For me, I would get so into the game that my surroundings wouldn't even come into play. The big leagues for me, the hardest part was the stadiums. When they're taller, it's harder to track the ball until it gets up out of the stadium.
Oh yeah. Yep. Disappearing into the fans. Yeah.
It wasn't about, now when we played in Oakland, that place in the playoffs is a madhouse.
Oh, I bet.
It was so loud. It's a bunch of football fans, it's a bunch of Oakland Raiders fans going to a baseball game.
Yeah, they got vuvuzelas and drums.
Yeah. So much drumming. They have a kazoo guy now.
Yeah. The city of Detroit, the people there know baseball. They go to watch the baseball game, right? So it's not overwhelmingly loud until something happens. Like, it's like they know when to cheer and when not to. What I mean?
Right.
Or when to get after it. Like, oh, okay, it's the eighth inning. We're down by a run. We got a runner in second. Let's get loud now, right?
Yeah. Everybody stand up.
Where Oakland, in the playoffs, everybody just screamed the entire game. It was like nothing I've ever seen other than maybe the Dominican. But on a grander scale, literally, I felt like it was shaking a little bit. It was intense.
After
those games, we're all like, whew, and I'm like, thank God we got good pitching.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's like an echoey concrete, you know, monolith out there too. It really does seem like it's like echoey compared to some other stadiums as well. So, oh, those must have been some crazy games to watch. You know, Scherzer and Verlander, you know, kind of deal the way they did in that series. I mean, it was bananas.
Oh yeah, when I was there, well, the reason we were good, our starting pitching staff. You think three Cy Young winners, Doug Fister, and then Anibal Sanchez. Like,
yeah, pretty good, pretty good.
We had so Porcello in the bullpen.
Yeah.
Right? He was a Cy Young winner.
Yeah. And he never got to pitch. Like, he hardly pitched in that series. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. But those guys, you know, hats off to them and what they were able to do. I do think, in all honesty, that the way that their fans were, it was a detriment to their team as much as it was ours.
Oh, really? Kind of psyched them out a little? Because
the whole game is just loud and screaming, and, you know, so their guys are feeling it just as much as we are.
Oh, that's interesting.
Even though it's their home stadium, right?
Yeah.
There's a point where there's so much noise, it's hard to channel in the focus. You know what I mean? And that's the whole point of getting loud for your team at the right times. I think because they weren't savvy enough to understand that this isn't a football game, and we all just want to go have our drinks and get loud and rowdy.
Yeah.
You know, that, I think it was a detriment to their team.
Yeah, because you've got Josh Reddick up at the plate. You know, he's in a pressure situation trying to get a key hit, and the stadium is just absolutely going bananas around him. You know, it's like that might be the time to cool it down just a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a fact. And that's kind of, you know, learning, like, part of the home field advantage is your crowd. You know, a little bit of your comfort zone because you play there more, but also your crowd. Like, when are they getting rowdy and when are they not? And that's a big, big thing.
Well, and it could be.
That's what I thought.
Is it tough in the postseason, too? Because when you're at home, you've got, you know, like friends and family all, you know, kind of want tickets and people are coming and you're kind of hosting people at your house. Like, those kind of things can kind of come up. Whereas when you're on the road, you know, your mind is clear. You guys are all in the hotel together as a unit. Is it actually easier, do you think, to be on the road in a certain sense?
No, so like with anything at the big league level, and I was only with Detroit, but I would imagine most organizations try to do it similar. They cater to what you need. They want you to focus on the game. So with the tickets, what they would do is once we got into the playoffs, you would buy a ticket for all the series. So like if my mom and dad want to go, we just buy them all for the whole series, and then what you don't use, you know, you don't pay for, obviously, if you don't make it as far. But all the tickets were already set, organized, ready to rock before we even played game one for all the way through the whole series.
That's smart.
Yeah, that is smart.
Yeah. And they know that's an organization that knows what they're doing. Been there, done that, right? We want these guys to have the least amount of worry other than the baseball game. You know, there's more media days and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, when you're in the playoffs, you're jazzed up, you're excited to be there. So the only detriment that we ever had in the playoffs was when we swept the Yankees. We had like 6 or 7 days off or whatever it was. It was wild.
Yeah.
We had guys come up from Lakeland to kind of scrimmage in an empty Comerica Park.
Oh my God.
It was the weirdest thing ever. We're out in playing a scrimmage game on Comerica, on the field with no fans. And for us, we're used to the place, you know, having at least 30,000, you know, what I mean? Like on the day game.
Yeah.
So it's like you go from playing the Yankees to the loudest crowd that I ever saw in Detroit when we beat the Yankees to nobody in the stands trying to practice, like trying to simulate that. It's impossible. And we came out a little flat against San Francisco. Now, hats off to them. They beat the Cardinals in a 7-game series like cutthroat. Like right towards the very end, the Cardinals probably, they had it, and then San Francisco beat them, you know. So they came off of right out of that kind of mindset of the wildness to where we were on like a 8-day or 7-day, no competition. We play every day in baseball. That's the longest stretch we had off for the whole year.
Yeah, that's longer than the All-Star break.
And then we go
break.
Play the whole series.
Yeah. That must have driven Jim Leland. Do you remember how he was responding to any of that? Like trying to keep you guys, you know, keyed up and in that frame of
mind?
It's
not an excuse.
Sure.
I think it's just
the
reality,
way it is. Yeah.
Right? We all were doing everything in our power that we knew how to do to be ready for those games, you know, but even Verlander came out and got hit around a little bit in game one. And that was kind of like, ugh. You know,
yeah.
Here's in that time off. It's just tough. You're not going to the ballpark with the same mentality every day. As hard as you try, it's impossible. You know, so that was probably one of the harder things that we had to do, and we just couldn't get it done. Even as good a guy as we had, and as professional as those guys were, it's just tough to lay off baseball that long and then go play at the highest level on planet Earth. It's not easy.
Oh, and you're taking that time off.
And we
failed right at that.
We lost in four games.
Yeah, yeah. I remember.
I was at game four. Yep. It was really cold.
I still have bad feelings about Pablo Sandoval every time I think of him.
Yeah.
Curse.
Yeah. And it was, you know, we couldn't get it back on track quick enough. You know, the last two games, we were starting to play better baseball. But it just, if we could have won game three, you know, that might have been a different series. Game one and game two, we weren't there yet, you know. And it's just part of life, you know. We look back and we say, you know, we did everything we thought we could do, and they just beat us.
Yep. And, you know, and people, you know, fans will argue about these things for years about, you know, should Benoit have thrown the change up to Ortiz, all these little things, but... You know, those are the moments that stand out, and it's the accumulation of all the little moments that happen in every one of those games that it's, you know, everything could have hinged on any moment. You know, it's only in retrospect that we kind of apply that kind of meaning to this pitch or that pitch because it didn't go right. So we're all trying to explain it to ourselves.
And if you'd have thrown the fastball and Ortiz hit that out, why didn't you throw your changeup? That's your bread and butter pitch.
I know.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
You know, like, so yep. Ortiz, it's basically, that's what makes kind of the legend, though. Like guys like Ortiz in the playoffs, right? He had a way to come up with the big hit. And who knows, if Benoit throws the fastball, he probably was either going to foul it off or something and get to the next pitch regardless, right? It's not like, if he'd have thrown the fastball, he was out.
Right.
Would that have changed? And maybe he hits a double in the gap on something else or walks something. Like, you can't go back and say, well, he shouldn't have thrown his best pitch.
Yep. All that stuff is just madness. Yeah, it's madness, isn't it? Just trying to think your way out of stuff that's already happened. There's just no point.
And you see it like the Seahawks. They didn't give the ball to Lynch. That's their bread and butter right there.
Yep.
Oh, it's your bread and butter in the crunch time. If they beat you on your bread and butter, tip your cap.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So I don't have a problem with the change up there. Hey, that's my bread and butter pitch. That's what I need to go to in the clutch situation. Let me tell you this. David Ortiz has driven in a lot of runs in his life.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like,
yep.
It's not like it was Ozzie Smith up there who clipped him. You know what I mean?
Yep. It's one of the greats of all time.
You got slider bat speed and you threw the changeup, right? David Ortiz, it's not like it was something. It's just part of baseball. It's part of the beauty of the game. The moments that happen, the big moments, the things that you remember that stand out, right?
Yeah. Yep. Those are the things that end up defining things. Do you have any particular memories of Jim Leland? I mean, we're all huge fans. What was his impression on you as a player for him when you first?
Yeah, Leland never said a lot to me. He kind of let me play. I think he knew, even when I came up and he watched me play, he's like, I know what I'm going to get out of this guy every day. I don't need to say a lot to him to get the results. And if he saw something in my game or something, you know, he noticed, he'd just pull you over to the side and say, hey, you know, maybe think about this next time. He had a very subtle way of staying out of guys' ways, and he trusted his other coaches which is one of parts of his success. You know, he wouldn't go against what Mac would tell me hitting, which you see managers do. You know, you see managers that don't trust the guys around them as much as Leland trusted his guys, Gene Lamont, and, you know, all the different people that he worked with. He really fed into those guys and gave them a role that they could be proud of doing. It wasn't like he was the power hungry manager that he needed to rule over everybody, because those guys aren't as good, right? You see that all the time. Those managers who want to micromanage everybody and say, oh, we need to do this with the hitting, we need to do this. You see that more in college and stuff, but even at the big league level, you know, I think one of his assets was understanding his strengths and then trusting his guys to help produce results. Now, if something wasn't going right,
sure,
he would address the team. He would address the team with what we needed to do as a team.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't as much an individual, hey, you need to do X, Y, and Z because that's why we're failing. It was always going back to the team. And that's where his managerial skills were very strong. You know, how to keep a team united. Sometimes he would get everybody pissed off at him to make us play better. And he knew how to do that.
Yeah.
You know,
and there's all that experience. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he was okay with being the bad guy, which for most people would blow their mind, especially in today's world. You know, I want to cater to these all-stars and make sure that they're well pampered. He didn't care who you were. You know what I mean? Like,
he already had Barry Bonds.
If he needed to get under somebody's skin a little bit to motivate him, he wasn't afraid to do it. And I think that's kind of what separates him. And you see it, anybody that's seen a Jim Leland interview, he knows, they should know that man cares about winning baseball games. And all the other stuff around it doesn't matter to him. Like, yeah. how do we win this baseball game? That's what he cared about. And I think he also was very good at managing bullpens. And that might have been some of his NL experience too. You know, I think he did a very good job for what we had. And he trusted guys. And he gave the ball to the right guy in the right position. And also knowing when to pull the starters, things of that nature, I thought he was exceptionally good at.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And how to shake a lineup up. He was kind of, you know, they talk about a lot of these guys, these managers now, like all of a sudden Rizzo's hitting two hole for the Cubs.
Oh, sure.
Well, Leland's been doing that for years.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah, like, Leland has been doing that before it was even popular.
Yeah, that's interesting. You see a guy like I know Bruce Bochy, who's another kind of old school guy who's got a ton of experience as a manager, does that kind of thing quite a bit as well. He's more willing to kind of play with the lineup, more willing to make a change if he feels like, you know, they need a little spark and that kind of thing.
Yeah, so, Leland was stupid enough. He hit me in the three hole one time.
How'd it go that day?
Good, really good. I think I hit a double and a. drove it a couple runs.
That's awesome. He could feel
there
it.
You go.
But he was, you know, the other thing about Leland that I always admired and respected, and I think that most outsiders looking in wouldn't realize it, is he, as a player, he always had your back. Good, bad, ugly, whatever it was. If you played for Jim Leland, you could count on, if you were playing hard and working at it, he would have your back through thick and through thin. In the media, with other people, he never threw guys under the bus. It was always, you could count on him to have your back, as bad as it was, even if you're getting sent to AAA, whatever, right? He was a guy who was there, the commander, a true leader. You know, he's a true leader. He's one of those guys that he's got his guys back. And he doesn't get to choose the guys on his team.
Got to play with what
you... But when you play... You could play with what you got if you play the game the right way. And that's what he always liked about me. I was out there, you know, dirt ball, blue collar guy, which is his bread and butter anyway. That's kind of the way he is, right? So he loved that about me and gave me a lot of opportunities. And I'll always be grateful to him for giving me opportunities and trusting in me enough to give me the opportunities he did give me.
Oh, that's great. You know, it takes people so long, I find, you know, in leadership positions to learn how not to overdo it, you know, to learn that light touch, to learn to, you know, to delegate and, you know, and to have the right people in place with the right plan and to stay out of their way unless you're absolutely needed. That's really interesting to hear you kind of put Jim Leland in those terms, because that's, you know, that's like, that's the highest level of management, you know, of, and I think sometimes people forget that it is, you know, it is a job, it is a workplace that you're in there. And if Jim Leland is in there yelling and screaming at somebody every day, eventually that kind of effect wears off, you know, like you got to know how to make these things happen with the lightest possible touch without, you know, wearing people down.
Okay. I'm just going to bring this up.
And that comes with experience, you know,
I just want to bring up one of my favorite Leland memories, because Andy, you were actually a part of it. And it's probably the greatest Jim Leland ejection of all time. And it happened when you were at first base in June of 2011. And I want to know if you remember that at all, because it's like, it gets played ad nauseum, and Leland is actually one of the most ejected managers of all time. But like this, this particular ejection was just like his like gold medal ejection. And it just happened to happen when you were on plate. So I'm just curious if you remember it at all, or if it kind of got lost in all other ones. It was versus the Jays.
It might've been a play. Did I bunt the ball and beat it out to first, and they called me safe and then called me out?
Yeah, they reversed the call, and then Leland mimicked.
And
the
Leland just
reversed
lost
the
mind.
Call, and this was before instant replay.
Yeah.
So the guy, the umpire, called me safe, and then he did an out sign.
Yes.
Like he clearly called me safe. Cool. And then he did an out.
It was almost instant. Right, like he changed his mind like right away.
It was like safe out.
Yeah.
And then Leland is like, obviously, that's a point where a manager is going to be like, what are you doing out here? You called him safe. You have to go with what you call first. Like, I don't care. You called him safe. You got to go with your – that's like saying strike ball.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't make sense.
Because technically he reversed his call. There. Yeah, he reversed his own call basically immediately. Yeah.
So and that was before we – instant replay and stuff.
Yeah. Are you dying laughing?
But he was great. He was great at ejections. Oh, another good Leland story. With Jared Weaver threw over Alex Avila's head. It was after, Carlos hit a bomb. Maglio hit a home run to left field. And, you know, typical Maglio, he wasn't like, he was just kind of looking at it to see if it's fair or foul as he's kind of trotting down to first base in his little Maglio steps, you know. And then Weaver thought he was pimping it, you know.
Yeah.
So Maglio crossed and Weaver starts chirping at him. Maglio and Carlos are good good friends, you know. And so Carlos, when he hit his home run, he is just like yelling at him. He didn't even – he hit the ball, threw the bat down, and is instantly – he's not even watched the ball to see if it's coming out of the yard. He already knew it. He's instantly looking at Weaver and like chirping. Like,
oh,
You know, we're not doing that. So then Avila gets up, and Weaver throws the ball over Avila's head. Like, come on.
Yeah.
You know, that's, there's no need for that. If you want to plunk a guy, throw at his legs, you know, throw at his body.
Oh, and he was
he throws it like
mind.
Right over Avila's head.
Yeah, Jared Weaver was losing it.
Weaver
he
just,
was so hot.
Oh, he's lost his mind out there, and he's on the mound yelling and yelling and yelling. And Leland, at the time, I don't, you know, he's 60 years old, whatever. He goes out there and he's yelling at him. If you want some, come and get it.
Oh,
he's
wow.
running out there as the benches start clearing,
oh,
and he's
no.
yelling at Weaver, let's go.
Oh,
if you
my
want
God.
It, come and get it, you know?
Oh, my God.
It was just classic Leland. Like, Leland would probably have fought him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like,
Leland, Weaver is like 6 foot six and like 6'5", 240 pounds in great shape. He didn't care. But that's part of what I mean, like, having your guys back. Like, he threw it at Alex, his catcher. He wasn't going to have that. Like, no, that's not going to happen. You know? And as Weaver's going away, Leland's like, get over here.
Oh, wow. That's so awesome. Yeah, because, I mean, he threw it over his head, too. It wasn't like he got mad and, like, decided to plunk him in the butt. I mean, that was dangerous. That was a dangerous pitch. Ooh. Oh, that's a great story.
And that's part of, you know, he's got his players back. And I don't know, you know, sometimes we have this out-of-body experience. If you looked at it in reality, if you match Leland against Weaver, Leland probably shouldn't even have been saying anything, but that's just that's his personality. He didn't care. You know, he would have taken a beating if he had to for his guy.
Yeah. Oh, he's a beaut. I love that guy. He's the best. Yeah. Oh, all right. Well, you know, we've had you for well over an hour now. So I think we'll let you go. Is there anything you wanted to promote, though? Because we know you had a couple of charity events coming up pretty soon.
Well, you know, I'm involved in as many charities as possible to whatever extent I can get in. Boys and Girls Club in Troy. I'm a board member on that. We have New Day Foundation for Families is something that I feel really strongly about. If you look up New Day Foundation for Families, it's a great organization that helps people with cancer diagnoses. We're doing the autistic awareness with the pizza guy. Coming up too. He's got a podcast. I was on his show.
Oh, awesome.
Good guy.
Freddie the Pizza Man.
Freddie the Pizza Man. He's, you know, does a lot in the community, autism awareness, things of that nature. To me, anybody that's out there trying to support something that's a good cause, that's a just cause, like these people do, as much as the media tries to flip stuff and say that, you know, America's so bad and all these people are so bad in America, blah, 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 we can never get on the same page. I think if you just really look at in detail of what just normal people in the community do on a daily basis, you'll see the complete opposite. And it doesn't get promoted enough. There's not enough light shine on it. I'm talking even teachers, you know, that are paying for their own materials, that are making $30,000 a year, buying their kids construction paper and glue. Yeah. Like those are things. If our society was really as bad as what the media says it is, that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, you know, it's like anything, you know, the worst stories will get emphasized because they're just, you know, they pop and that's kind of how it goes. But yeah, I mean, day to day life, you know, you see people helping each other out all around. It's definitely a different perspective on the ground. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can always donate your time.
Absolutely. You know,
that's one thing people don't realize. It's not all about monetary donations. A lot of it's time. A lot of these organizations need people to volunteer, to help, right? So you got to have the money. Sometimes you need the money, people, but you also need people to donate time, ideas, maybe their skill set.
Yeah.
You know, donate your skill set. If you're good on a computer, maybe you can help somebody develop their website. Things like that that go a long ways. That a lot of people think I ain't got time for that or whatever. You can just make some time. Think about how you can help an organization. And just ask. Hey, how can I get involved and how can I help? You know, time is, we're all busy. Yep. And that's what, okay. Yeah. Last topic of the day, right? So it drives me nuts and I always do my best to be on time. People, you know, they'll say, oh, sorry, I was late. I was busy. Well, if you looked at my schedule, you'd be like, wow, that's a busy schedule.
Yeah.
You know, two toddlers, two businesses, on a podcast at 11 o'clock at night, like you're never, everybody's busy. So respect other people's time. You know, things do happen. Well, the beauty of cell phones is send a text. Hey, I'm running 10 minutes behind. Okay, cool. But don't just not do something. You know,
that's my thing.
It's just that, like, take responsibility, you know, don't waste other people's time and be responsible to the people who are giving you their time, you know? Yeah.
And things happen. Right.
Sure.
Everybody's aware of that, but on a consistent basis, just like a baseball, just be as consistent as you can to try to, you know, be on time, respect other people's ideas and thoughts. I am what some people would consider. They think that I would be a know-it-all, but in reality, I'm trying to learn like everybody else. That's why I get, people's input on my podcast. I'm getting coaches, parents, scouts. You know, it's not just me sitting up there saying what I know. I need to get these other people's knowledge because they've been in a different position than I have. That can be very relevant and helpful to people.
Yeah. And the best teachers are always people who learn the best. You know, it's people who are committed to constant learning and constant kind of striving to get better. Those are the people who are in that mind frame, you know. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
So speaking of the podcast, is it on a regular release schedule? Where can people find it?
Yeah, just if you go to, I got a couple Facebook pages. My person that runs my social media puts it out on Facebook. It's on iTunes. It's on a gamut of.
It's on Spotify. That's where I found it. So.
Yeah. So Spotify, iTunes, you just look up Get Your Game Right, and it'll be on there. Also, if you go to my Facebook page, you can go to my Instagram account. You can go. We haven't been as involved in Twitter.
Avoid it if you can.
Yeah.
It's so scary some days. Know. Instagram's nice and it's friendly. It's all pictures. It's so much less. It's so much less hard on your soul.
Yeah. Well, and what people don't realize is words hold more weight than anything.
Yeah.
What people say in the era we're living in, it's so easy to just sit back behind a laptop or a phone and type something about somebody that you'd never say to their face. Oh, yeah. Well, I had to tell my mom when I got the big leagues, Mom, just get off the internet.
Yeah. Like,
You're not going to see good stuff.
Don't set up an Andy.
They'll try to demean character. Yeah.
Oh man, that's a whole show topic of its own. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and my thing is, we're in America. We have freedom of speech. If people feel like they have the need to do that, go for it. I call them haters. And what I love about when you start getting a decent following of haters, that means you're doing something in life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That means you're starting to do something. If people are talking crap about you, it's because they don't like where you're at and the success you're having.
Yep.
And really, they don't like where they're at. And that's a way to avoid doing something about it. Yeah.
I always say, hey, if you wanna talk crap on me and it makes you feel better about yourself, I'm happy to do that for you. You can do it all day. If it makes you feel better about yourself, that's what my goal mission and on planet Earth is, to make people feel better about themselves and overcome obstacles, right?
Yeah.
So if you're having a bad day and if you need to release a little stress by saying something or talking crap, I'm like, if that's your outlet, go for it on me. Just don't bring it towards my family, please.
Yeah.
Right. Because you'll walk away from it with no thought. And if it makes them feel better, I guess whatever, whatever works.
Yeah. Yeah.
Andy Dirks, man, it's really been awesome talking to you. You kind of fought through some of our technical issues to stick with us, and I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Awesome conversation.
Yeah, no, thank you guys. It's been an honor to be on the show, and you guys are doing great stuff. Stay after it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, we'll talk to you shortly. Hopefully we can get you back on again before too long.
Cool. All right, thanks, guys.
Thanks, Andy. Have a great night.
You too. Bye.